Welcome to Crit Club, a show where four friends watch movies they've never seen from the Criterion Channel streaming service and then talk about them to their heart's content. My name is Peter Allen Clark, and I'm joined by three of the finest film lovers in North America. I'm joined by Wizard Chris.
Oh, hello, everybody. North America, at least.
What, not Brazil?
I think South America.
Not Brazil?
No, South America. Our Brazilian fans, we got a shout out to them as well. I'm joined by Corey. Hello, Corey.
Ahoy, ahoy.
And, of course, I'm joined by Angela. Hello, Angela.
Hello.
Well, it's my pick this week again. And I feel like I stumbled into a quintessential Peter pick. But y'all can correct me on that. We're watching Ingmar Bergman's 1968 film, The Hour of the Wolf. Now, I picked this film for three reasons. One, I wanted to watch more Bergman. Two, the channel had it categorized as horror. And three, it had wolf in the title, so I figured it could be about like werewolves or something. instead, Hour of the Wolf was something altogether unexpected. It's a small, tight story about a couple living on a desolate island, and while the famous painter husband drags his wife down into the depths of his insomnia, the few inhabitants on this odd island construct designs on them. It's a whirlwind of existential surrealism that spirals around its own inhabited force of creativity and artistic identity. But it might be easier to just say that Peter went and done picked another fairy tale. The first word spoken in this movie is Bergman calling action on the set. And I believe that that acknowledgement is that we're clearly watching a movie, which means we're supposed to understand that this is an exercise in dream logic and a meditation on the stories we tell ourselves when we're afraid. There's just so much here. There's narcissism, sexuality, shame, paranoia. But I really want to hear from the rest of this club. Did Hour of the Wolf keep you wide awake, or did you slam down on the snooze button? And we're going to go with Wizard Chris first. Oh. Wizard, what did you think of Hour of the Wolf?
I get to go first. I almost never go first.
I thought that.
Yeah. This was a lot of fun. This was, well, not a lot of fun.
Both Frida and I were like, Wizard's going to love this.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a great time watching this movie. It is super weird. It is creepy. It is one of my favorite kinds of like cinematic devices, is a world where everyone is like so normal it's creepy, and then they just slowly ratchet up the creepiness over the course of the film, which is something that happens here. It's very Bergman, and it's very Swedish, and you know, it's like very terse. It's very like these like beautifully constructed images. The lighting in this film is amazing. There's so many beautiful shots of people's faces and bodies that are just highlighted by this incredible use of lighting throughout the film. I gotta say that I like Bergman. I like a good like navel gaze from an artist, but like I also recognize why, you know, if this is Bergman reflecting on Bergman, like it must be exhausting to be around sometimes, because this is a movie about a man who is like, well, literally consumed by demons. But like I just had so much sympathy for the wife character in this film, because this is a movie about a man who takes up entirely too much space and has forced his wife to participate in his taking up of space. Yeah, loved it. Great time. Excited to talk about it.
Angela, I'm going to go with you next.
Oh, why
what did
are you
think
doing
of
this to yourself? Why?
What do you want?
Why?
No,
why?
There's only think of three other people.
Are you saying you hit the snooze button on Hour of the Wolf?
Oh, I think for the first time, even though I made a resolution that I wasn't going to stop watching one of our films, this film, I stopped watching it. I think you all know that part. I was like,
what?
Nope, sorry. In this
Where?
Climate right now, I've had a particularly awful month, and I just don't have room to watch violence against children.
That was another thing we said, is like, yeah. I wonder if Angela's going to keep watching when that scene happened.
Nope.
Yeah.
No.
I was very curious about what you'd think about the last 20 minutes, because I think there's...
I don't care. I don't care, okay. Because like, there's too much horrible shit happening to children right now that this presented as a form of entertainment and navel gazing. I literally got nauseous and wanted to throw up. I have a kid that age. Okay. I don't need to see this shit. I get that there was artistic license and blah, 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 but, it's just the same story that we've seen. I feel like we just saw, The Wages of Fear Part 2, the family edition. And I feel bad. I feel bad that, like, you know, I'm not going to have much to contribute to this conversation, and I'm happy for you all that you enjoyed this film, but.
Hey, we haven't gotten to me yet.
We haven't gotten to me yet.
Though I have one good takeaway from this cinematic experience. I'll save it for the end when I roll. But for now, I'm basically going to knit and listen to you guys chat about it.
You said you were excited to talk about it in the thread.
That was before I got to this part. I had initially fast forward. I was like, oh, there's a kid. Nothing good is going to happen to this child. I'm going to fast forward. And then I took a pause. I was like, you know, I'm going to watch the rest of this tomorrow. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to be brave. I'm going to just rewind it and watch it over and just watch the whole thing. Big mistake. Big mistake. I may have actually finished the film if I did the little fast forward and kept going. But no, I saw the full sequence of events. I gave Mr. Narcissist the benefit of the doubt. I'm like, maybe he's fighting that demon that was in the closet. No, it was gross. It was all the way gross. No, thank you. Moving on. Stop.
Boy, that is a bummer, because I was like, I really thought about you, Angela, over the last 10 minutes of this movie, of like, I'm really excited to hear what you say about like some of the things that happen.
I will maybe have an opinion based on what you guys saw. Because I'm just this month, I mean, yeah. I had to watch my kid broke his arm, and I had to watch him in the worst pain of his life and console him, and it took pretty much all of the emotional energy I have to be tough around children. And
no,
I
fine.
Don't
no,
have any
no
more.
Shame.
Sorry.
No shame. I Love no you shame. Guys. No shame. I just wanted you to know that I was thinking about you at the end of this movie. Corey, how did you find Hour of the Wolf?
Ingmar Bergman, more like Ingmar Boring Man. No, I like this movie. I'm just kidding.
I gotta say, yeah. You got me.
I did not love it. I think that kind of watching it was somewhat like laborious because. It has a really plodding pace, but I think that it really does pick up, unfortunately, after that scene with the kid. I think a lot of its themes start becoming even more apparent, and a lot of the first part of the movie where you are just kind of like, oh God, is this just some navel gazing, self masturbatory, like, oh, tortured artist?
Yes.
We've seen this a million times.
Yes, it is.
But then, like, I think towards the end, it sort of has more themes about, like, codependency and the people that, like, enable people to have this, like, you know, torture artist persona and stuff. And, like, I don't know. There was a scene when they finally go to the castle. I think the movie also, like, that was the first time that it really ramped up for me. I loved the whole, like, dinner scene and just, like, the constant going on about all their just inane bullshit that they're all just talking about and stuff. But then when they go and they look at the painting that he did that we don't ever get to see as an audience, mm-hmm. and they're talking about it, and it almost feels like these rich people are just, like, fucking with him by buying his own art and shoving it back in his face. I was like, this is cool. Like, this is a good idea. Like, and I was kind of hoping that was going to be more of the theme of it, because I think that on its own would be a great plot. And, you know, there could be more twists and turns and stuff, but like having like people like mess with you with your own art from the past and all, and I guess it is actually, because then he comes back and gets reunited with Veronica Vulgar and all that.
You missed more Bush, Angela.
I love a good Bush, but there is nothing. Sure. There's not enough Bush in the world for me but to want to come back to this. Thank you.
I will never say that personally. But but then towards the end, there's all this stuff with like Alma's relationship with him, and like, is she so enmeshed with him that she's making his demons more real, or they're becoming more real for her, and so she's not able to even separate. I don't know. I think there's gonna be a lot to talk about with the ending, and we can get to it when we get to it. But I did enjoy this movie, and I've actually like, it's weird because like, as I was watching it, I didn't love it, but then like, the more I've thought about this for 24 mm-hmm. hours now since I watched it, and like, my opinion of it is growing over time because it's given me like something to chew on and think about, which I haven't had happen for, I guess, a little while. So yeah, Peter, what did you think of it?
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah. yeah. I was pretty sure Wizard was going to be, I was like, me and Wizard at least will could be on this, but everything you all said, I guess I am well on the record, even in our last episode of Solaris, I'm on the record of being really, really patient with ponderous, slow, self-involved meditations on art and identity, and you know what? Here's another one. But it did. Not only did it work that same sort of magic that Wizard, I think you talked about on me. I think also this movie was very instructive in that it showed me a bunch of things that other directors and other movies have borrowed from, and I will argue later on, even ripped off of in a lot of ways. This was like, I think this filled in a lot of gaps within my film knowledge on its own, just looking at it as a piece of sort of like, you know, work. But thematically, I found it deeply fascinating. Like, I found it deeply sort of like, I don't have answers for what the hell happened in a lot of it, but as listeners will know, that never really matters too much for me. Like, mm-hmm. I'm a journey person, not a destination person. But even the few answers or the few sort of theories that I have around a lot of it are so complicated and dense and layered that I watched this movie, I was just having such a great time. I wrote so many notes. Oh my God, the notes I wrote down. And then I opened up Wikipedia to read about this movie. And I, for the first time that I can remember, at least in a long time, I closed Wikipedia as I was going through it and reading it because I wanted to think more about what I thought about the movie mm-hmm. before I went too far down a rabbit hole of the production and the reception and its legacy and all that sort of stuff. I don't know, for whatever reason, that's very notable to me that I wanted to spend more time in my own head with my impressions of it. I'm just really glad I did. This was a really fascinating, very odd, not perfect by any stretch of the means, but I think something that like I will also think about for a very long time.
Yeah, and I would say this is my first Ingmar Bergman movie, and like I did read the Wikipedia article on it. This was not like necessarily very well received at the time. In fact, it got a lot of like negative reviews, particularly in Sweden, and a lot of people saying like, "Well, this is just a lot of people are saying well, that's another one from Bergman," or like, "This is definitely not one of his greatest films," or whatever. So now I'm kind of like
more like okay, boring well, man.
Then, yeah, then I'm like, "Well, okay, then what are his greatest films?" Because now I'm curious because I did really like this one, so like if he's got better stuff, then I think I might have to like sort of go down a rabbit hole here.
Yeah, where do you all want to start? I mean, do you all want to like? I guess we can go plot by plot or piece by piece along it because I think that it's, as I said in the introduction, it feels kind of dream logic-y to me, and I think that there is a sequential feeling that you have scene by scene, but I'm not sure how reliable that is. Because it's like, let's start at the very beginning because I brought that up in the introduction. I really want to talk about the meta-ness of this. Mm. Like that oh, is yeah. obviously so intentional. And I did go back and read the Wikipedia today about, you know, how it's the first word is Bergman shouting action. And there's all this talk about like this movie set, like it's, I think, you know, like I said in the introduction, I really think that's meant to put some distance between the viewer and what you're about to see. I think that there's just like this whole very egotistical meta-ness around it. I don't know if that sort of filtered into your all's watching of it the same way it did mine, but I'm curious what you all felt about that.
I think that the movie is pretty transparent. I didn't catch, like, I caught the sort of like crowd sounds and the kind of like chatter mm-hmm. in the background, which like like, I didn't catch him saying action, but I caught that part. And so, like, it did bookend the movie. I was like, okay, there's something going on outside of the movie that I'm watching. It's like pretty trans, like, it's pretty transparent, like, when you're watching the movie, that Bergman is doing a movie about himself. And I'm sure he shares personality traits with a lot of difficult artists, tortured artists, what have you. But I you know, I've only seen The Seventh Seal and this movie.
Same.
And yeah, same. I think that it's like a fascinating movie that like really like tries to be like nakedly like personal, if that makes any sense. Like I think that because Bergman kind of introduces the thing and it is this sort of like surreal dream logic fairy tale symbolic story, I respect the decision to get like personal and weird, explore his feelings of shame about his art being co-opted, his complicated feelings about sexuality, whether these are directly him or just a, you know, representation of that kind of tension within creative people. I thought that like creating like an artificial movie or creating like a story within a story to kind of get that stuff out is a really interesting way of presenting, you know, yourself nakedly, but also putting some like layers there, plausible deniability, I guess, so that Bergman can say, well, this is not exactly me, this is all artists or something like that. I don't know if that answers your question, Peter, but like the artifice of the film or the box within a box of it is a interesting technique, an interesting device to use.
But I would even say it's boxes within boxes within boxes. I mean, I'm going to go back to The Shout, which, let me tell you, I turned this movie off, or near the end of this movie, I said out loud to myself, boy, I did love The Shout. but I think about The Shout's unreliable narrator of Girardi in this mental institution. He's telling you that I changed the ending, that I don't know what's going to happen. And to me, this Hour of the Wolf is the same thing. It's not only a movie set. The opening subtitles tell you this is based on a diary you found, but it's the woman telling the story. It's a movie of a woman telling the story of, you know, Johan telling stories. You know, it's just so far. Like, I mean, plausible deniability is one thing that I absolutely can see. I can also see unreliable narration. Mm-hmm. You know, and just the stories we tell, like, as the stories we tell ourselves when we're afraid, the myths that we make up to in our minds to help us spiral down those long insomniac nights.
Yeah, and help me piece it together, because then, like, after the sort of opening credits, it's Alma just talking directly to the camera for, like, a while, and, like, talking about his diary and stuff, but she is pregnant at that point, right? And I think she was, because she's saying, like, the baby's coming and all that stuff. So then, where is this in the timeline, now that I'm thinking about it? I don't know. There were so much, like, themes being thrown at me that I'm realizing now I didn't even, like, piece together the sort of sequentialness or not sequentialness of the, like, just plot. So
yeah, I don't know. What was, like, a month or two after he left or something? I don't know. A couple months after he left, something? 6 months? 4 months? Yeah. I guess. Corey, I guess I don't have a sense, Corey, about what you think about any sort of, I don't know if it's meta. Maybe meta is the wrong word for it, but this sort of, like, self-referential storytelling. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you got to, like, remember this is also, like, 1968, but also I'm sure that there were a million, like, novels and all that stuff, stories and plays and all that stuff written about sort of navel-gazing artists and stuff well before, you know, this came out. Mm-hmm. But, like, it has become such a, you know, cliche. But I think that it transcends just that. Like, I think that there ended up, like, in the at the end of the movie, it ends up not just being a self-referential navel-gazing type stuff, and it started to explore more things about, like, just the codependency type stuff between, you know, him and Alma feeling like protective of him or like, you know, responsible for him. Like, you could see like there were these scenes where he was, you know, just drunk and brooding, and you could like see on her family, they held on the camera for longer than a minute, obviously, because he was like holding, you know, he's counting down a minute and stuff, and you could just see that, you know, she wasn't counting, he was counting the minute, she was not counting the minute, she was watching him count the minute, because it was like, it wasn't important for her to measure the time of the minute, it was important for her to like see him, watch him counting the minute and stuff. So it's like she's so like codependently enmeshed in him. And so I think that like her kind of speech at the end, you know, talks about like, should I have loved him more? Should I have loved him less? I mean, that's still like also codependent talk.
Am
but
I,
it's like,
am I going to become him?
Yeah, am I going to become? Like, you're right, exactly. Yeah. Like, are we just going to become the same person and all that stuff? So I think having that in there, having Alma in there, makes this a more interesting story than just a, you know, another, you know, story about a writer, you know, a story about a, you know, author, a story about a, you know, artist or whatever.
I find it so fascinating that we know like nothing about her, really. Like, obviously a deliberate choice to on like she is obviously a deliberate choice on the Max von Sydow character's, what is his name, as Johann. Like, whatever we can suss out about his torrid love affair with Veronica, we can tell that this is like a very, that she's like probably a high society lady. This was a huge controversy. Like, he is an artist, and she is obviously somebody important. And it's so bad that they like flee the country. Like, he's come to this island in a kind of like self-imposed exile because of whatever happened there. And he brings with him this woman that he's having a child with, who seems like to be a caretaker, and she dresses like very simply. Like, I get the impression that she's either like poor, like significantly poorer, or like from like a rural background. Like, you get this sense that he's like, I need somebody to take care of me so badly. I am a complete mess. I am going to pull this woman out from the Swedish countryside, and she's going to take care of me, which is a shitty deal for her. Really, really shitty deal for her. And
woman or child? Like, he picked her intentionally. She is a person without power.
Great point.
This whole thing, to me, like, the more I hear you guys talking, I feel like I'm just watching justifications, not of what you're saying, but like, what's happening in the film is just one giant toxic masculinity dump of like how men take advantage of women or use women to validate themselves. And, you know, like, it's navel gazy, but like, what are we actually learning here? Maybe I missed the end of the film and there wasn't like some sort of redeeming thing, but
yeah,
well, no, I don't think the film is uncritical of idea that it's supremely selfish and shitty, like his behavior, and that he's dragging this child, this like very young woman along with him. I don't think the movie's uncritical of that at all.
No, I don't think so either. And I think that's what made me like it is, this might be me extrapolating stuff or creating meaning where I don't think maybe there actually was or not. But what it got me thinking about was, her talk at the end, her talk throughout is like, are we just going to become the same person or whatever and stuff? And so she is talking about becoming, you know, just codependently enmeshed with this person. And then her thing at the end where she's talking about, should I have maybe like cared less and loved him less, or maybe I should have loved him more or whatever. Something in like what she was talking about almost made me feel like, so he goes through this whole thing where he goes back to the castle. He sees all these people, which I guess we'll just call demons. I don't know if they call them demons in the thing or not, or if that was just a word I picked up from, you know, reading about the movie. But he goes through and sees all these demons and stuff, and then she chases him and finds, like, goes running to him in the forest. And then her talk at the end is almost like, because she is so enmeshed with him, his own personal demons have become her own personal demons. So his own personal demons become manifest and real within the reality of the movie, and so they also become manifest and real for her because of how enmeshed she is with him. And if maybe she wasn't so enmeshed with him, she would be able to navigate the sort of, you know, torturedness of his own mind and stuff better, because she would be able to not see these demons as being a real thing. Mm. And so I don't know. I left with that with like a good message of, you know, being sort of like acknowledging your own codependent enmeshment, where like this person's problems are my problems because I'm so codependent on this person. And maybe if I would have like kept some distance with this person, I could have still maybe helped this person, but they wouldn't be my own personal problems where I'm also seeing the demons. I'm also fighting the same demons. I don't know if that's the real message of it, but like, that's what I hope it is, because I like that. I thought that was good at the end.
I also see kind of a sad message, though, in the sense that, like, this is a woman who you can, like, through the lens of the film, we see has suffered, like, a not insignificant amount of, like, emotional abuse and a lot of, like caretaking and mothering of her partner and that kind of stuff.
She's being forced to stay up all night, and she's pregnant. Let the woman sleep.
And at the end, she does that terrible thing that people have experienced, like partner abuse of one kind or another, where she's like, I should have done something. I could have done, if I had done this, he would have been better, or like, if I had done something differently, this could have worked out better. And I think that's like, I think that's tough. That's again, like she's very young and very like, very, you know, I like what you say about codependence, Corey. She is in the process of like unmeshing herself from this tortured artist that dragged her along on this fairy tale adventure.
Who she doesn't even know. Like, she doesn't even know him until she steals his diary to actually find out who he actually is.
Yet she is tied to him forever because of the baby. That's the scariest thing.
I don't think you're wrong at all, Angela. I think both things can be true about this, right? Like, I think because that's something that's, I think, unavoidable to talk about with this entire movie, is because we've all said navel-gazy and narcissistic and self-referential and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, that's always going to be sort of a subjective line of, is this a story that is worth being told by this person about themselves? Is this a story that is worth my time to hear about, you know, of somebody's focusing so, you know, so clearly on their own ego? And, you know, I think this movie reverberated for me because I saw enough of myself in the good and bad, I guess, of the story being told. Mm. But I also think that I agree with you, Angela, of like, that does that excuse, it's worth the question of, does that excuse like just giving this story, this platform, this time to what is essentially a narcissist person abusing another person?
I don't think he doesn't come across as like a good guy. It's not like they're painting him as like some sort of hero. I mean, I think it's like similar to like, you know, you watch almost any Martin Scorsese movie and it's like, you know, he's, you know, doing movies about like the worst people in the entire world, you know, gangsters and, you know, Wolf of Wall Street, and like these are horrible people, but because they're the main stars, they become glorified and stuff. So I guess you could make the case that, like,
but there's
because
no glory this guy in is this the star movie.
Yeah, because this guy is the star, like maybe there you could sit make the case of like he's being glorified or whatever here, but like that's not how he's being portrayed. He's not being portrayed as like something to aspire to or someone you would even want to be around. It's not like anyone's watching this movie and being like, gee, I wish I could be married to him. It's like, no, this is what the story's about. The story's about a self-absorbed narcissistic director confronting his demons.
Like, I feel like I'm starting to get all those Woody Allen jokes about Ingmar Bergman movies. In his movies, say, you know, oh yeah, I'm gonna do my favorite thing. I'm gonna go watch a Ingmar Bergman movie. Which let's tie it to another guy with questionable toxic male
cool
issues.
Dudes.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, right?
Cool dudes. But wait, but like, oh, sorry. Go ahead, Angela.
Oh no, I can't remember. It's okay.
But I mean, but like, so I think the thing that really connected me so closely to this movie, and I think a lot of the emotional undertones of Johan himself, is the creative, and he uses the word compulsion, which rang my head like a bell. Like, I took pictures of this fucking speech because I thought this speech was so fucking amazing. Like, these couple of lines that what I am quoting here is at the end of the dinner where he says, Forgive me, I call myself an artist for lack of a better term. In my creativity, nothing is self-evident except the compulsion to carry on. Like, the, it's a disease, it's an addiction, it's a compulsion. Like, I really, and I'm not sure if I've ever heard anything so clearly lay out what is at times, what is at many times, my own personal creative compulsions. Like, I don't think I'm good at any of the stuff I do, but God damn it if I haven't made sacrifices, and God damn it if I haven't upset a lot of people in my need, in my, you know, personal addiction to do so. And I think part of that is the reason why I guess I am a lot more patient about these very navel-gazy movies of like, what is art? What is an artist? How does an artist art? Mm-hmm. What, well, arts does artist what, art art?
What is art? And like, what is, you know, part of the reason why I don't like this film is because and you know, we talk about like what makes a Peter film, what makes a Corey film, what makes a Wizard film, what makes an Angela film. And when I'm going to the theater, I want to be transported. And I want to be kind of relieved of the stress of my life. And these kinds of films don't do that for me. They make it worse. And so I think that it's just going to be really hard for me to judge this movie cinematically rather than personally, because I just have a hard boundary where witnessing cruelty to children is like an invitation to other people to be cruel to children, and puts me in a spot where I can imagine what is it like to be that cruel to a child. And that's terrifying. I mean, if we're talking about a horror movie, that's the most horrifying thing I've ever witnessed on film, honestly.
I really want to talk about that. I really do next. I also want to say, to cap off sort of my conversation about art, is I think this movie is very, very smart in never showing any of his art, and never showing any of those drawings of people. Like, it's Marcellus Wallace's soul, you know, it's the briefcase, right? And I think that, like, this movie about this artist, about his compulsion to create, is all the more richer to me for never having showing any of it, because he could be fucking terrible, and the only people who collect his art are the people like these who are out to fuck with him over it.
I don't know. That scene where they see his painting of Veronica is so devastating. Like, I really get the sense from her Alma's face that he is really good, and he'll never, like, and like his like passion for this person is like written all over this painting. Mm-hmm. And even though they've talked about it, even though he's been not honest certainly, but like, even though he's been upfront about some aspects of himself and his past, like when she sees that painting, it's like all laid out, and she's like, oh my god, I don't know this man at all, like at all.
It almost made me think of, like, you know, someone like finding, you know, 10-year-old texts of like their ex, like, oh, and you're reading it and like, oh my god, this is what their relationship was, like, this is, what is this? It was almost that level of, intimacy, I guess, you know, that you sort of felt described to us about this painting that we as the audience couldn't see. I think, though, just to cap it off on this for me, is like the difference between like this and The Shout is The Shout did not give me anything to think about. I couldn't even
watch it again.
Yeah, I couldn't even tell you like what The Shout was even about.
All right, we open upon
right, but like with this, I'm like, I think I have a pretty good idea about what this was about, and I've been thinking about it for, you know, at least a day now, and I might even think about it for longer. So that, I don't know, that's kind of what makes it better for me, or more of an interesting watch for me.
So let's if it's okay, I would like to talk about the violence against the boy and what the fuck y'all thought was going on there, because
let's take a step back. Who's the kid?
I've got my theories. It's okay. I would love to hear what you all thought. Yeah, it's a metaphor.
I'm like, is it supposed to be himself?
I have my explanation. Yeah, all right. I absolutely have my episode. But no, I want to hear your all's, though. I mean, I'm happy to go. Because, all right.
You got me.
Let's talk about what this movie is. Because I think, I'm going to write a fucking paper about how the similarities that this movie has with The Shout, because I'm about to keep going on this fucking tip. Just as The Shout lays out everything that's going to fucking happen in the opening sort of monologue or the opening scenes, I feel like this movie also does the same thing with Johan very quickly the relationship is turned and he starts brooding and being insomniac. He throws down those sketches and he says, you know, the bird man, the woman who takes off her hat, you know, the Spider-Man, like all of this becomes true. But do you all remember the first thing? I went back and I rewatched that scene after this is all over. Do you remember the first thing he says? I should have written it down, because he says, this is the most common person, the most common man. I think he's homosexual. I absolutely believe that the violence against the boy was a metaphor for repressing sexuality or sexual urges. And smothering them. I absolutely think that is absolutely what is happening. And then when you get to the end, when there is the gender, all of the things with
you
gender.
See the flashes of the kid. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, I very much believe that's what happened in that scene, but I'm curious if you all
I'd
have
buy
other
it.
Interpretations.
That fits. And just kind of like the way that they were like filming the kid luxuriating on the rocks and stuff like that. Was just kind of like,
which was so creepy.
But it fits with what Peter's saying here.
Yes. You know? But, and this kid is a kid. Yeah. And is now put in this situation to be looked at in a sexual way. I just think it's like, I think it's the height of like male power to put kids in that position. Like he doesn't give a shit, because we didn't give a shit at that time. And I get it. Wow. Wonderful. Great. They get to do this exploration and it's art. But to me, it is also like exploitive in some way, and I am literally sick thinking about that scene. Like
Angela, but you also had the same reaction when Agnes Varda did that with,
for sure. Anytime children are used in this way,
but that wasn't a male doing it though. That was
I think that at the time there was an attitude that was permissive, and it seems to happen a lot in European films. Maybe it's because we in the United States, maybe we are puritanistic in this way, and so we have such a huge reaction to such things. But I find it all gross. I'm grossed out.
It's definitely icky. It's definitely icky. Yeah. And I mean, like, that scene, I love how you don't know who that kid is, and then he just starts being a little goblin imp, just like scrounging around everything. I don't know. Like, I found no other way to sort of interpret it.
Mm-hmm. I found him as a curious kid. Like, where did this kid come from? There's a kid, some random kid appears. To me, it's just like, I wasn't really paying attention to the other. It was just another excuse for this guy to be a jerk. Like, why does this guy get to be a jerk? And now he gets to be like the worst jerk by basically killing a kid.
Yeah, I feel like the end of the dinner scene, like there was the dinner scene and then there was that. I thought it was fucking stunning. The puppet show, with that person in there. I thought that was both
Frida and I turned and looked at each other with confused looks.
I thought it was absolutely stunning. But that was the scene where I was like, oh, this is not reality. All reality is out of bounds. Mm. This is a movie built out of metaphors and dream logic. And so, you know, I can't be looking at all of this as literal sort of happenstance.
when the old lady comes up and she's like, I'm 216 years old or whatever. I was like, oh, okay, we're in a David Lynch movie. And then the guy's like walking on the walls and walking on the
ceiling.
I thought of David Lynch too. Yeah. Lynch obviously loves this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No, but I don't know. But like to me, that was like I went back and rewatched, and it's. I really wish I'd written down the quote, because he's very clearly talking about himself, that he thinks he's homosexual, and very like that the luxurious, which it is icky. I very much agree. Like it seemed like that was absolutely sexual urges repressing, you know, smothering them.
I immediately buy it.
Yeah,
I buy it.
Yeah, yeah, that makes that. Yeah, that's that. Like, like repressed sexuality is such a theme in the film, and that like that violent like attack on like a part of yourself, the way it's kind of depicted in the movie, it's troubling, and it kind of comes out of nowhere. Like the movie's been like creepy, but like not scary in the same way. But yeah, I can absolutely see that as like a metaphor for like burying some part of yourself that doesn't stay buried. Especially in light of, I thought that line at the beginning, it was very like pointed and unusual, Peter, that you were saying, like he's like, this is the guy I draw most often, and it's like he says it very matter of factly, if I remember, he's like, this is the person I draw most often. I think he's a homosexual, and very like just flat.
Because everyone else shows up. It seems, you know. The spider, like, took me a second. The Spider-Man is the guy walking up the walls.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, he's a spider. I thought it was just a weird David Lynch thing. Oh, shit. I forgot.
But
somebody else
didn't
talk.
You guys not also make the connection between the kid and the story of him in the closet and the little...
Thank you. That's what I was just going to say. Yes.
Yeah. That's how I didn't look at it, because I was just so squeamish and grossed out about the whole thing. I was like, I'm going to focus on this kid as possibly like a reincarnation of the imp thing. But still, I couldn't get over it. Sorry. I tried. It didn't work.
No sorries, please. But yeah, thank you, Angela, because that was actually what I was trying to think about, was because that on the Wikipedia page, there was like somebody suggesting that it was like the lack, you know, that boy just having his own idle time and not beaten and locked in a, you know, a closet or whatever. He was acting out his rage against his own lost childhood or something,
That's
which I believe too.
Yeah.
It can be
all of those things.
Yeah.
Very unlikely that it's a legit murder, though.
Yeah.
Which I guess is okay.
So do you all want to talk about the party, the last festival?
Well, I think before
we get
to that.
Go ahead.
I think something before is just like, I don't know. Is anybody familiar with the magic flute? The Mozart
opera?
No,
tell me more about it.
No, I don't. I wish I did.
Oh. But they also, Bergman did a whole movie of the magic flute.
Oh. All
right. So he seems to be quite taken with it. But otherwise, I know nothing else.
It's Mozart? Is that right?
It's Mozart, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Sorry, listeners. We are an uneducated
bunch. I am going to the opera next month, but it's an Italian one, not a German one.
Get your money back.
All right, yeah, let's talk about the ending.
Yeah, it's a big party. Big party at the castle. Mm-hmm. Everyone's invited.
How many people die?
Difficult to say. At least... zero.
Does?
But
okay. Figuratively, do we have any deaths?
Possibly up to two or three.
How many of them were actually alive to even begin with?
That's a great question. Ooh. That is a great question.
I love, speaking of like Mozart, I love that the harpsichord player. It was a perfectly
love a spooky piano player.
When are you gonna watch Amadeus, Peter? You need to watch that movie.
Ooh.
You gotta watch that movie. Make it so.
I'll do it this winter.
Okay.
Yeah. Big party's going on at the castle. Everyone's going to be there, including Veronica Vulgar. Mm-hmm. Va-va-voom.
Do you think Vulgar translates?
Has to.
God, I hope so.
I don't know.
Probably not.
Wait, before... there were definitely a number of Swedish words where they would just like say stuff, and it's like, you know, they would just say music or sit. And it's just like, oh, those are you know, roots that we have in common or whatever and stuff. I'm just wondering if like Vulgar is also like a translation. I don't know. Maybe there's something.
Man, I wrote down so many fucking notes, because before even he goes to the party, he gets the invitation to the party with that guy who gives the gun. But the guy had said, for all the trouble you've had with all the small game on the island.
Really? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, but it's in its own way, it's telling that this guy knows even about everything that's going on with Johan. I don't know. The whole thing is, it's a dream island.
Mm-hmm. So it's a terrible dream island.
We're all living in a mass of our own consciousness. We can't escape the island.
Not wrong, Peter. You're not wrong.
So he gets this invite to this castle, but before he can do
and a gun.
So before he can go, he's got to fly solo on this one, which means he has to, for one reason or another, shoot his wife.
There you go.
Which,
really?
Well, yeah, she's okay.
I'm so glad I didn't keep watching.
She's okay. She's okay. Yeah, he just hit her arm and she fell over in shock. And then he's like, all right, done what I need to do. Let's hit that party. And it's David Lynch from then on out. It is pure nightmare fuel.
It is the end of Mulholland Drive.
Which obviously was great. Which was obviously, like, there were so many fun shots. Like, it is...
The desolate rooms.
Becomes
like
a Bauhaus music video. Like, oh my goodness.
I really love, I wrote down this other quote. God, I love so many quotes in this. Because the owner of the castle tells him that he's also, that Veronica has been his lover. Mm-hmm. And he just says, so deadpan, he says, I can assure you, I'm suffering. same, bro. Same, dude.
I can assure you, I'm suffering.
But yeah, because it's the Birdman who puts on makeup on him and puts him in a feminine robe and... You know, makes him into a, I don't know. What would you all say that is? I mean, it blurs the line of his gender in a way. And I really like the line there, which I didn't write down, of like, you look more like yourself and also not like yourself. Mm-hmm. Perfect combination for a twit, for a tryst or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like a combination of like embracing parts of his repressed sexuality, but also it gives him a very like opera clown vibe, which is very intentional. You know, he's the fool at the center of the story who's like stumbled into, kind of like the ending of Wicker Man, like you go to your own demise like willingly and in costume.
But did I read too much into that? Because to me, that really read as feminine.
Oh,
like,
very much.
That was very much blurring of
very,
gender.
Very so, much.
Absolutely.
Very
I mean, lipstick,
much.
Eyeliner. Yeah, it's all. Sure.
Like, yeah, and the line about you look more like yourself, but also not, like, because he wants to not be himself, but also more himself. Like, it's very like, you know, there's sometimes movies can be like very on the nose, and you feel like you're being insulted watching them, or like the creator is doing too much like spelling out of the themes of the film. And I could see a legit criticism of Hour of the Wolf in that, but I like, for me, I just, like, these images are constructed so beautifully and presented in such a striking way that it's hard to be mad about it.
Wait, I've got a question for you all, though, because one thing that's still unclear to me, I would just love this. I'd love to hear your thoughts, because he's just so desperate for Veronica.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, there's the scene of the older woman asking him to kiss her foot, you know, like, he's just doing all these things, and this desperation just becomes very intense. And I'm really, I guess I'm wondering where that desperation comes from, or what is the driver, the inspiration of that desperation? Is it just, I mean, because they sort of built it up as this big love they had, but that sense of passion I felt was lost. What didn't exist for him from him until the very end? And I'm curious if you all thought there was.
Right. I mean, I saw it as like a muse. I mean, it's like this muse that he's lost. I mean, this is, you know, I just, from the scene where they're looking at the painting, it almost seems like this was his, you know, almost partner in creating some of his most powerful art and stuff, and now that's lost. And so it becomes very important for him to try to go regain that.
That's good. I like
slowly
that a lot,
been
actually
unraveling without her, like, just, you know.
I also see you know, sexuality is complicated, obviously. We talk about that a lot on this podcast, I think, and I think that in addition to that this kind of muse relationship, he also, you know, we're dealing with a lot of like repressed queerness, I guess. And part of what she represents for him is super straight. Like, this is my, like, this is me at like my most like straight. I'm banging this hot blonde. I'm an artist. I'm like, this is me at my like peak masculine experience. And I think we see that when she wakes up and she laughs at him. Mm-hmm. She just starts laughing at him. And
then just, like, kissing him wildly and just, like, shoving him. Like I think also, like she's also, like, danger, too. Like, because they were having to sneak around. They weren't able to, like, you know, be, you know, sort of public with their love. And so, like, that stuff's exciting, you know, especially when you're younger and stuff. Like, having that sense of danger and stuff to it. And so, yeah, he's probably just lost that, too. And you can see, once she, like, snaps to, you can see, like, oh, she's sort of a live wire, kind of like the opposite of Alma.
Mm-hmm.
And they all laugh at him.
And they all laugh at him. And you know, they're
Adam Sandler.
They're laughing at him because he's
fake.
He's being fake again, or you know, there's the whole element we haven't discussed about that's like very like naked in the film is this complicated feelings artists have around selling their art and the people who buy their art, like these fucking vampires who live in this castle, who like put his art up in their bedroom, and they're vapid and they're uninteresting, but they're wealthy and they control the purse strings, and so I'll go to your stupid party, and I'll pretend to have a good time for as long as I can. I'll take a lot of shit.
I'll shoot my wife, you know, so I can go to this party. My pregnant partner. Well,
but that's a great point. Like, she represents this like boring aspect of his life that he's not, that he thought he wanted or he was willing to like give a shot or something like that. And again, bad dude. Don't bring other people into your like crisis of image or whatever. But there is that element of him being like, oh, like I tried to settle down, and you know, I'm not straight. I'm not a dad. I'm not this dude who wants to live in this like peasant hut and make art. I think there's so much of that in this film where he's like, what I thought I wanted out of this, maybe I don't want as much, or I'm tempted to go back to bumming around Europe with an heiress kind of thing. I think all of that is at play. And also, this issue of like art and capitalism and money all making things complicated, getting you away from the thing that you would rather be doing, which is drawing terrifying images or hot pictures of your heiress squeeze.
Yeah. And then there's the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm. His demons.
I like that the what's his face gets a good slap back.
It's
so good.
In retaliation.
Really good slap.
And I liked the bird man.
Mm-hmm. I see this as her chasing him into this forest with all of his demons. That's her just throwing herself into his psyche with all of his demons.
Boy, Corey, I love that interpretation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I will confess the hardest time I had with this movie was that very end, where I felt like we had the denouement, like we had all of this, and it felt like, let's keep going. This movie should be over, even though this movie's like 127 minutes. This is a very tight movie. But I really, hearing you talk about it, Corey, I really buy into that interpretation, and I think that's really sells me on this movie more than what it did when I was watching it.
Yeah. Yeah, and then it just clicks off. We already did the credits.
And then,
it just ends.
And then he disappears, and she is alone with a baby and a cozy hut on one of the Faroe Islands. Did he bail? Is he dead? These are important questions that make for great post-movie chatter.
Sequel.
Year of the Wolf. I feel like you can wrap that into more of artistic narcissism, right? Mm-hmm. Of like you're trying to leave a lasting impression on the world, but in the end, you just, you know, dissolve into the forest.
I feel bad about our introduction of the term narcissism into this movie, because I just feel that narcissism, I feel it implies a certain amount of like toxicity, and I agree that
this is one of the most toxic movies I've ever had to watch.
It's
aware of its own toxicness. Like, just because the character is bad doesn't mean the maker is bad.
It's like, just like It's
an examination of that toxicity. I think.
I don't think this is one of the. This is. I mean, like,
it's just
toxic
gross.
And.
Like Deep Cover. Can we just take a minute to go to talk about toxic films?
Yeah. I mean, we've watched more toxic movies. Yeah. I would feel.
Black Moon is more toxic.
This is an examination of being navel-gazy, of being self-absorbed, of all of that stuff. And so I think if it was just doing that just to be you know, self-promoting and stuff of that stuff, like, it would be a different story. But this is an examination of that stuff. I don't know.
Maybe it's a little narcissistic, sure.
I'm fine with calling it narcissistic. I mean, like, I still think I agree. It's a toxic movie. It's not one of the most toxic ones I've seen. But, like, I do think that, like, it is him setting the parameters and setting an abusive sort of environment for the woman carrying his child. Like, with everything has to go through. I think narcissism is, to me, it's very narcissistic. But wait, I want to read this other quote because this is also part of that same speech he gave at the end of the first dinner party, because I think it fits in with the end of it well. Is he says, "I have felt megalomania brush across my brow, but I believe myself to be immune. I need only for a moment consider the insignificance of art in the human world to be brought back down to earth." And I think it's that disappearing into the forest to be that insignificance. I don't know. I want to bring up one more movie that I would argue is vastly more toxic than this. But also, I feel like I saw this movie 3 times in the movie theater. Big fan of this movie. And this is also, having seen this movie, I'm like, oh, fuck. He just fucking stole this goddamn movie. And I'm very annoyed by it.
Ooh.
Of course, I'm talking about Darren Aronofsky's Mother with an exclamation point.
I haven't seen Mother.
I saw that a long time ago, and I saw it when it came out, and I really don't have very much memory of it.
I'm so sure I'd love it.
I saw it 3 times. Hey, let me tell you, it's not great, but I would watch it again in a heartbeat. But it's like, it is so heavily. Listeners, please write in. Tell me how right I am, because it couldn't be closer to this movie. It is an artist trapping a woman in his house at the expense of his obsession over his own artistic endeavors while the world, you know, tears her apart.
God.
I don't know. It's, it's very extremely, it's way more toxic than this.
Is it also a metaphor?
Please do not watch this movie. Please do not watch Darren Aronofsky's Mother. Please don't even look up anything about Darren Aronofsky's Mother.
3 times.
It is also a metaphor. Yeah, it's a ride. It's a fucking ride, Wizard. It's a fucking ride. Mm. Do you all have anything else that you all want to say about?
I mean, I just want to say this movie is, like, gorgeously shot. And
it really is. The cinematography, the black and white. Oh my god,
the black and white. They're really sort of wide angle lenses with, like, the deep focus where, like, everything is just in focus and there's just so much detail on the screen and, like, just so many good shots. And, like, I just remember, like, the scene of, like, him kind of, like, raising his head up when he's like got all the makeup and it's all just smeared and he's in the castle at the end. And I'm like, oh man, it's such a good shot. And, like, I don't know. There's just, like, lots of, it's a good looking movie.
So, I couldn't agree more. Yeah. I'm glad you said that. This is one of those that's like, you know, it's 1968. The color movies have been around forever. And it's like, if you had any question about why you would choose black and white, it's because he can make them look this good.
So good.
I mean, I just, so strikingly realist. I don't know, I just fucking loved the look of it.
So many like close-ups on people's faces and just like the way that everyone is lit. Max von Sydow is a square-headed, craggy-looking dude, and I love his face in everything. He's a great exorcist. He's an excellent crusader in The Seventh Seal. Like, whenever you see him, he is an incredible genre actor. And just the way he translates on screen in this movie, it's super goth. Love it.
Super goth. Yeah. You all ready to roll? I am if you all are.
Yep.
Yeah. So.
Well, here on Crit Club, listeners, we do things a little differently. We rate our movies because we're a bunch of D&D nerds, even though we don't talk about it near as much as we should. we rate our movies on a scale of 1 to 20, 1 being a fail and 20 being a crit, hence our name. I'm going to go the same order that I started with. And Wizard, I'm going to turn it over to you to ask, what are you rolling on Hour of the Wolf?
This is more challenging.
Hold on for a second. Also, listeners, there will be a spreadsheet of all of our, it's the first time I get to promote it. If you listened last week to our 51st episode extravaganza, you got access to our spreadsheet, and I'm going to fill it out real time here. Sorry, Wizard, go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. This is a tricky one because I have a lot of feelings about this film. I guess it's not that tricky. This was an 18 for me. I had a great time. Ooh. It was super fun.
Angela, you're up next. What are you rolling on Hour of the Wolf?
It gets a 3. That's it.
Okay. 3.
That's it. It's not a fail. I get whatever artistic value is. I appreciate Young Frankenstein a little bit more because I feel like it's a parody of this sort of movie. And that makes it funnier. And for that, it gets 3 points.
Corey, how are you rolling on Hour of the Wolf?
I really liked having watched this movie more than I liked actually watching it. I did enjoy watching it, but I enjoyed having watched it even more. So I'm kind of rating it on like how I feel having watched it, and I'm feeling like a 14 on it. I think it's good, it's beautiful, it's given me a lot to chew on, and I'm interested in watching more Bergman.
Before I type this out, though, Corey, as we talked about it last episode, it took a walk after you watched Sanjuro to realize that you shouldn't have given it a crit. Are you sure you should be rating it on how you felt about watching it?
What do you mean?
I don't know what I'm meaning. I'm just trying to give you shit.
I think I'm feeling a 14.
Okay, that sounds great. What am I rolling on this? I mean, Wizard, I was thinking 17, but then you said 18.
It's not a competition.
I know it's not a competition. I think I'm going to go 17. I didn't talk a lot about sort of some of the problems or some of the some of the ways that I didn't connect with this movie, but I feel like there are a few things where I would have wanted. This is one of the few movies where I'm like, give me 5 or 10 more minutes. Like, give me a little bit more deep, complex sort of understanding of what is so alluring or compelling about a Birdman or a Spider-Man. I mean, I guess, you know, it does kind of does it on its own. But I think I connected extremely heavily with this movie, but I still saw enough cracks along the way to think that 17 is a pretty damn good score for this. And so that's where I'm sticking on this.
Pretty damn good.
Wow. Wow. Hour of the Wolf. Hell of a good conversation. I really appreciate you all talking to me through that. That was super fun. Mm-hmm. Don't watch Mother, except for Wizard.
I'll watch Wizard. You should watch Mother.
but also, I swear to fucking God, this is the same thing that happened a couple years ago when I read Roadside Picnic, the Soviet sci-fi book that I think I've talked about a few times on the show, and I read that and I'm like, holy fucking shit, Jeff Vandermeer and all of the Annihilation books are just Roadside Picnic. Like, I hate when you find that piece of art that somebody modern has not stolen, but it really adapted heavily, and you're like, ugh, original's better. Anyway, that was Hour of the Wolf, our discussion on that. You can tell us what you thought about Hour of the Wolf by emailing us at quitclubpodcast@gmail.com. Angela's excited face.
I would
What's
like
up?
For you, we're going to play a game. Guess who messaged us? We did get our first email. You know, but that's not
fair. I have to refuse myself.
Yeah.
I do not know.
I can't imagine.
Oh, you can imagine now. Corey just gave it away, party pooper. It was Frida. Frida hey, messaged hooray. Us. Do you want, I shall read the email. It's very short. Hi, Crit Clubbers. Congratulations on 51 episodes. Y'all are my third favorite podcast.
Third favorite, yeah.
Very curious.
Top three.
What the other two are. I'm positive one of them is a like the last murder on the left or something. I have listened to every episode. I enjoy listening. Thank you, friends. Frida. Do you want to have your letter read on the air? Just send us an email to critclubpodcast @gmail.com. And we will play the game where we guess which one of the people we know has messaged us. Bonus points if it's someone we don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do that. Reach out to us. Let us know what you thought of this movie. Let us know what you thought of previous movies. Tell us what you want us to watch. Tell us what you like or do not like or would like us to talk about. We'd love to hear from you. For next week, oh yeah, folks, it's time for another Wizard Pick.
We are back with a wizard pick. Oh my goodness.
What are we watching?
We are going to stay in the land of moody black and white people. Very exciting. We're going to be watching Abel Ferrara's 1995 adventure, jaunt, romp. I don't know what you'd call it. We're going to be watching The Addiction on the streets of Greenwich Village in NYU. Yes, an NYU philosophy student finds herself the victim of a vampiric encounter, inaugurating an insatiable craving for blood that drives her to the depths of junkiedom and existential despair. Shot in moody black and white chiaroscuro, Abel Ferrara's harrowing metaphor for heroin addiction swirls Heidegger, Catholicism, and gangster rap into a potent art-damaged reflection on guilt and redemption. It's Bad Lieutenant with vampires, people. I am excited.
Strangely.
Cool. That's the walk-in effect, I think you'll find.
I think, yeah. I had the same feeling about Comfort of Strangers.
So this one, so we may be missing a Halloween just a little bit with
just
that one.
Just a hair. Okay. It'll come out, I think, Yeah, it'll come the week of Halloween. Yeah.
All Saints Day.
Yeah. Yeah, but we'll still, I mean, we jack-o'-lantern all year round, so, you know. Join us on that. We jack all year round. Let's.
That silence spoke volumes, everybody.
I've been up for a very long time. Let's wrap this podcast up with our last segment. Just a little bit of a check-in that we'd like to call "What else you watching, Wizard?" What else have you been watching? Let's start with you.
Oh, starting with me. I haven't had much time to watch anything, I'm afraid. I've been playing a little Baldur's Gate 3, which is great. And I strongly recommend everybody play it. Writing is solid. Voice acting is solid. Adventuring, solid. Beyond that, I have plans to watch some scary movies tomorrow, which I'm very excited to get on. And yeah. That's it, unfortunately.
What are the scary movies that you're planning on getting on?
So I'm going to watch The Autopsy of Jane Doe, finally, because I was going to watch
that. I rewatched that.
Oh, yeah.
After you said that you were interested in it. Yeah, it's still a ride. It still holds up.
It's still a ride that holds up. And I've got one more that I'm supposed to watch tomorrow. Cobweb, which I think Lizzie Kaplan is in.
I just finished that before we started recording.
Wow. I'm trying to read Peter's face. Think. Yeah, okay. I'll let you know what I think.
Let me know if you want another recommendation. Angela, what else have you been watching? I would love to know.
I've been playing Baldur's Gate, hanging out with the Asterion, which may be why I'm into vampires right now. I watched this horrible movie, which is making me wonder if like this European cinema thing is just persisting. I couldn't get, like, the second half. I had to turn it off. It's this horrible film. You should not watch it. It's so bad. It's called The Seduction of Erengard. It's German overdubbed in English on Netflix. It's problematic in so many ways. All of the ways. I can't even describe it. It was a costume drama. I entertained it for quite some time. But no. I instead turned on Call Me Kate, which is a documentary about Katharine Hepburn, which was just okay. It felt very sanitized, probably because it was sponsored by her family and her family participation. I am sure that Katharine Hepburn was far more scandalous than how she was portrayed in this documentary. I mean, she was lauded for being a feminist and coming from a feminist family, but... I am sure there is much more entertaining, salacious gossip to be known about Katharine Hepburn, and you do not get it in that documentary.
Looking for the Hepburn tea, eh?
Yeah, she had a longtime best friend who she was with, like, through the end of her life, and they just sort of bash, like, wave away any notion of like a romantic part of that friendship, like that if you had asked Katharine Hepburn, she would have been said, "What malarkey," or something like that. And I don't know. I would even want like the fictionalized version of that story somehow. But yeah, that's all I'm watching. I'm just putting on TV to try to escape from the rottenness and evil that has been the world lately. And yeah.
Cool. I wish you well in that endeavor.
Yeah.
Corey, what else have you been watching?
I watched the first four Paranormal movies after Peter talked about them last time.
Hey! Yeah!
Frida is same movie!
Frida is continuing on. I am opting out of the remaining ones. Although I might watch the Japanese one that came out as Paranormal Activity 2.
Did you enjoy any of them or find any... can you rank them?
The first four. Like, the first one, you can tell, is, like, a good movie. I remember at the time, just even having the whole found footage stuff, like, I saw it in the theater, I think.
Me too.
And I remember going into it being like, oh, this is just another found footage, like Blair Witch or whatever. And like, yeah, it's probably inspired by Blair Witch, but it's like a good, super low budget, like
so
almost feels like homemade, like, you know, horror movie that was like, you know, creative and good. And like, I don't know, I really like that one. It's I don't want to spoil too much about like the other ones, I guess, necessarily, but it's weird to me that they're like all connected. Like,
did you enjoy that? Like, I think I said this last week on the podcast that I love the lore that they built up around it. Like, I think it's honestly pretty solid, and like, at least compared to other franchises, like, it's a pretty solid mythos.
Yeah. It surprised me at first. I was expecting more separation from each of the stories, and like, yeah, it was just interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think the first one is like a good movie, and then they start going kind of slowly downhill. And then like the fourth one I had checked out because it's the same movie over and over again. And then like the fifth one I walked in the room a little bit here and there. And I'm like, oh, this looks like just complete ridiculousness at that point. So it feels like it's sort of jumping some sort of a shark here. So, but yeah, I have all the faith that Frida will continue and watch all the rest of the franchise.
Wait, they do jump. I guess that you do on the fifth one. Sorry, spoilers for the fifth Paranormal Activity, because one of the big conceits in that one is that they find a camera that shows the paranormal activity, that shows the ghost or shows the thing. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and I guess I also liked the ways that they played with this being like recorded footage within... You know, at least for the first couple ones, it's like, you know, well, how are they, like, are people just going to be setting up their cameras, and then how are they going to do it? And I'm mad about the one that's set in the 80s, that they didn't actually film it on VHS. And they didn't even, like, try to make it look like VHS. Like, I wish they would have made it look a little more like you were, like, watching old, you know, 80s movies and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't know. It's some popcorn Halloween movies. And then I had one other, like... Did I talk about Renfield when I watched it the first time? Like,
no.
Months ago?
I would love to hear.
The first time.
Yeah, I watched Renfield like when it first came out on streaming or whatever, and then I just watched it again this weekend.
Is that good?
It's excellent.
What?
Excellent. If we were reviewing it on this show, it would be a crit for me. It is going to be one that I watch over and over again. That is a Corey Cannon movie. It has... such a tight script. Every scene is just like...
This is the Nick Cage.
Cage and what's his face? The other guy as Renfield.
Angela is mouthing so bad.
I saw it in a bar in Seattle 2 weekends ago. And I like... It was a quiet moment mid-afternoon. And it was all right. It's not a crit.
Did you actually watch it?
I did. I was watching it, and then I got to a point where I was like, "Wow, this script like is just hitting every single point." And then I got annoyed because it was just there was something rote to it, and also the color palette was making me nauseous. Like there was something that color palette that they used. It was like straight out of the 1980s. It was like living. It was like Barbie before the Barbie movie, but not nearly as good. No, I get it. I love Nicholas Holt. I wanted that movie to be good. Really wanted it to be good. It's not awful, but I see why you like it. I get it.
I'm gonna talk about it a little bit more.
Go for it. Yeah, I'm surprised as hell. Go for it, please.
It's absolutely hilarious. It's really creative with its source material.
There's a lot of self-help in it.
I'm sure. And it's what makes it better than it needs to be, is because it's the whole thing is about codependency. And I'm not really ruining anything because they establish it right up front that this
it's
is going to
filled.
Be.
An, yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be an exploration of like codependent relationships. And they actually like do that and like lean into that. Like,
oh,
because
it's like
hard.
A support group. I remember that in the trailer. Mm. Yeah.
But they actually like end up like saying good stuff about codependent enmeshment and all that stuff too. It's just really good. Like, it's one of those movies where you just like watch and you're like, man, I wish I would have like written that, or I wish I could have. I don't know. It's great. I love it. I highly recommend it.
It's incredible.
I hope I'm not hyping it up too much. Like, I don't know, like, because I went into it with like low expectations.
Angela, you don't know what I love.
I went into low expectations, and then I watched it. I'm like, oh, this is way better than I thought it was going to be. And then I watched it with someone who hadn't seen it, and they were like, no, that was really good. So,
I'm just surprised, but I can't say shit because I feel that way about the first five Paranormal Activity movies. Because I rewatched all of those in the past. Like I said, I was. And boy, that seventh movie, I remember it being a lot better than it was. That's a real rough, not great movie. But as for me, I bought the ticket. I sat for 3.5 hours and I watched Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon.
I knew you'd be the first.
Yeah. It was opening day, and tickets weren't sold out, so I did it.
The tone of your voice when you said, I bought the ticket, makes me concerned.
Did you take a ride?
No. I thought it was okay. No, I thought it was good. I thought it was really good. I have, like, complicated feelings about it. I think it's a complicated movie, and I think it's meant to sort of have you get down in the mud, sort of in the way that a lot of Scorsese movies do. I think I can say it was one of my favorite movies he's done in a while that I've enjoyed. I think it's my favorite that he's done since Departed.
Really?
Yeah, I need to watch Wolf of Wall Street again. I did not connect with that movie.
Oh, I've watched that movie 40 times.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And like, honestly, a reason I want to watch that one again is because you like it so much, Corey. But no, Killers of the Flower Moon was like just a very, I didn't know anything about the story going into it. And I was pretty nervous seeing the trailer that it was going to be some sort of like White Knight bunch of stuff. But it isn't exactly, but it definitely is. It's pretty pro law enforcement movie, so I think I've got some complicated feelings about that. But I think also it's just a really fascinating story about American history, and I think they do an incredibly interesting job of putting a very complicated love story, relationship story, sort of in the middle of it. And the biggest compliment I want to give to it is Lily Gladstone, who plays, you know, the female lead. She's just fucking stunning. With her scenes with Leonardo DiCaprio, you're like, get out of the way, Leo. Let me watch this woman fucking act circles around you. I don't know. It was just like, it was 3.5 hours, but it didn't feel like that. I was very happy that I sat through this sort of saga and epic. It felt like a rare form of a movie. And while, you know, I don't think it was, I guess I would say it was great. I'm not head over heels about it, but I certainly am very glad I watched it. And I think it's a really fascinating movie as it is. Besides that, I brought Spider-Man 2 on Friday and I've just been playing the new game and it's great.
Great.
Yeah. It's exactly.
Yeah, I don't have a PS5, but I would like to play
it. It's fucking great. Yeah, it is. It's exactly more of that. And they refined it and shaved off a lot of the rough edges, and I'm having a wonderful time with that. Mm-hmm.
I played Spider-Man 2 through twice, and it's one of the very few games that I've 100%ed. Spider-Man 1.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You haven't played Miles Morales then?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, yeah. Fuck yeah, man. This is just, I want to say more of that, but I think it's better. Like, I do think they've really shaved off some rough edges, and I think this is a very focused, very fun experience. Well, friends, is that the end of this podcast? Well,
can I be self-indulgent for just one
second? Yes, please. So my friend, be navel-gazy. Be narcissistic. Yeah,
right. My friend Ted sends me the same video every Halloween. It's a two-second long video from the Peanuts Halloween special, and I just want to play it here because that's it.
Woo-hoo! Was it the owl?
Yeah, it's the owl. It just goes, hoo-hoo. Oh, he just sent it to me. Sorry.
Well,
this is our Halloween episode, so sorry.
Ooh,
I guess it is.
It is. Ooh, I should have fucking thought about that. I could have a really good.
I thought that's why you picked this movie.
Oh, sure. Yeah, but I would have for my I don't know. Please, listeners, I've got so many I'm just dying for someone to ask me for fucking horror recommendations because Wizard won't do it anymore. So everyone out there, just
I did it like
write
two weeks
in.
Ago.
I'm teasing you. Thank you all very much for listeners for listening to us and email us
quickclubpodcast
at gmail.com. Find us on Threads, social media at Crit Club Podcast. And next week, watch along with us where we will watch what again, Wizard?
Abel Ferrara's The Addiction.
Ooh, The Addiction. Thank you, Crit Clubbers. Thank you, Wizard. Thank you, Angela. Thank you, Corey, for talking through this movie. Thank you, listeners. And we will see you all tomorrow. Or wait, next week.
Next week.
Bye.
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 Bye-bye.